watching old Hoptoe.
Welcome to the Pine Barrens podcast. Today we'll be talking with Joanna Berger, who has been working on wildlife issues within the Pine Barrens since the early 1970s. We'll focus mainly on the northern pine snake, but also touch on the broad conservation issues that we urgently have to deal with over the next few years. So, Joanna, please introduce yourself.
I'm Joanna Berger, and this is my 50th year teaching at Rutgers University. I'm a distinguished professor of biology, and I've been working on snakes since I was a little kid.
So when was your first time in the Pine Barrens, if you can recall that?
Probably 1974. I came to Rutgers in 1972, so it would have been shortly after that.
So what was your first impression of the place?
Boy, that's an interesting question. My first impression of the place, let me see. Well, first of all, somebody, Ralph Good, I think it was actually, took me down to see the pygmy pines, which is why we first went down there. And I couldn't believe that there could be pine trees that were that old, that were that short. So I was amazed that you could go from a pine barren so short to a pine barren so tall. But the first thing I want to say is I grew up near the Albany pine bush. So I had spent a lot of time in the pine bush near Albany. So I was used to kind of pine barren's habitats.
So did you feel like a little bit of a sense of home coming to the Pine Barrens?
Yes, because it was a habitat I had gone to a lot, and a habitat I've heard a lot about from my parents and my grandparents, because my grandmother used to go over to the pine bush to pick blueberries. I mean, that was like a big thing, but they had to go by horseback. I mean, by horses, you know, so it was like an all day excursion to go to the Pine Barrens in Albany to pick blueberries. So they did it like once a year. It was a big thing. So she used to talk about that. She did that when she was a little kid. So that was kind of fun. So I like seeing the Pine Barrens, and I felt at home. And I like those kind of open but closed environments. I mean, it's not like a grassland where it's completely open, and it's not like a tropical forest, which is really dense and I get claustrophobic in. I like the pines because it's open and it's closed, and it has both kinds of habitats. And you feel, particularly in the New Jersey pines, more than the Pine Barrens near Albany, because Albany, the city of Albany, which is the capital of New York, is grown around it. And there's very little of the pinelands left up there. So what I really liked about the New Jersey pinelands is that you can walk for miles and not see anybody, and not see a road, and not see a truck, you know, or something else.
Yeah, I think a lot of people feel that same way. So broad level, why do you think it's important for people in New Jersey to care about what happens here in the Pine Barrens?
You know, there's a lot of different answers to that and a lot of different ways to look at it. All kinds of different habitats are essential to maintain our biodiversity and for maintaining carbon fluxes and for keeping our physical environment safe. And the pinelands, particularly the aquifer, the pinelands is incredibly important. That's our drinking water. That's our water for aquaculture. And if we deplete that water, we don't have any more. If we wreck this aquifer, we are the ones who are going to suffer. That's kind of the long game approach about it. But on the short game approach, it's one of the main habitats in New Jersey, and it preserves a lot of plants and animals that aren't found anywhere else. And the unique thing about the New Jersey Pine Barrens is there's lots of plants that occur in the New Jersey Pinelands that only occur further north or further south. And we're kind of the transition. And that's true for animals as well. It's one of the places where you can find some southern species and you can find some northern species. But the really reason that we need to preserve the New Jersey Pinelands is it's now a habitat that's an island amid an urban grid that goes from Boston to Washington. If we lose the pinelands, species that exist there have nowhere to go. A pine snake can't walk the hundreds of miles to North Carolina or Tennessee to find other pine snakes. And a tree frog can't go to the Pine Barrens in Long Island or upstate New York. So it really is an island treasure that we have that other states don't have. There are other pinelands habitats, but many of them are surrounded by other kinds of pine forests or other kinds of wild habitats. This one is simply not. There's no other Pine Barrens habitat in New Jersey. And if this goes, we've lost a lot of our diversity, a lot of our wonderful wildlands. That's probably more than you wanted.
Oh, I think that, you know, I think that's exactly it. So you mentioned pine snakes. So you, how long have you been studying pine snakes in the Pinelands?
Since the mid to late 1970s, Bob Zappalardi got me interested, particularly in pine snakes. I've always been interested in snakes. As a little kid, I used to have a lot of garter snakes in the wooden basement of our house, and I always had a lot of frogs and so on. So I always liked snakes, but he first introduced me to pine snakes. And he and I, along with Mike Goshfeld and Emil and several other people, have been working, including yourself, actually, have been looking at pine snakes for a long time. But at first, it was just Bob and I alone going out there and looking for pine snakes and trying to find hibernation sites and to learn more about them, because they're kind of the top level predator, at least of the snakes in the Pine Barrens.
So in the public culture, sometimes snakes get a bad rap. Why is that? Why is that wrong? And what should we be telling people?
I want to answer that two ways. First of all, public culture is not the old-time piney culture. The old-time piney people who lived in the pines, and probably the Native Americans as well, did not dislike snakes and did not dislike pine snakes, because wherever they tried to grow any crops, they would leave areas at the end of the field for the pine snakes, because they ate the mice and the other critters that were eating their crops. And so I think this dislike of snakes in the Pinelands, if that exists, is a newer thing, not the original Pinelands culture. But why people should care about pine snakes is that, in fact, all the different species in the pines play a different role in the ecosystems in the Pinelands. And pine snakes are one of the top level predators that are maintaining other populations. And if you lose a predator, what happens is you have the other species that this snake has been eating, the pine snake has been eating, you have competition between those, and you can have prey species increasing to greater numbers, and mice and rats and squirrels and other things increasing to greater numbers and competing among themselves. In other words, every species is a check on other species and maintaining a balance of the relationship between predators and prey in a habitat. And when you remove a predator, it causes a lot of problems. I mean, that's why they wanted to reintroduce wolves places in the West and other places, because if you don't have the predators in the system, the species at the lower trophic levels actually don't do as well. But the other reason we should preserve pine snakes is they're iconic of the pines. They're not hurting anybody. There's no reason to kill them. They're not going to hurt any animals that people, you know, can't replace. And it's important for us all to sort of try to keep the Pinelands and other habitats as much as possible the way they had been, because we never know, if you remove one species, what effect that's going to have on the whole system. Lots of people have tried to restore many different habitats without any luck. And sometimes it's because they don't really realize what species are two are the ones that are missing. And we don't know enough to be able to figure out those kinds of things. And it's much easier to preserve the habitats we have than to try to restore them. It's much easier to spend the little amount of money that we have to spend at this time to preserve habitats and preserve species and preserve pine snakes than it ever is to try to restore the habitat to have the pine snakes, or to restore pine snakes themselves, because animals want to go back to where they were, and trying to introduce them someplace else doesn't usually work. First of all, there are other animals there, And secondly, it's not home. And they will try to go home, crossing roads and crossing railroad tracks and crossing whatever they have to cross to try to get there, which usually doesn't work very well.
So in order to preserve the habitat, are we just talking about closed canopy pine forest? What kind of habitats within the pines are we talking about that's most important to preserve for pine snakes?
Well, pine snakes require a matrix of habitats. They require some aquatic habitats because they do a lot of foraging along the edge of little streams or some of the little wetlands that are in the pines. Those are really good places to search for small mammals. They're a place to escape from predators, but as we discovered recently, they could also be a place for snakes to escape from a really hot fire because they happen to be, if they know their habitat, they know where everything is and a fire is moving through. If they have time and can get to water, they can prevent that. But that's just because we had a recent fire and I'm upset about losing some of my pine snakes. But basically what we have to maintain is an intermix of habitat, which has some open places for nesting, some half canopy places for the edge of nesting and for hibernation sites, some deep forests because they're good places to look for prey, some aquatic habitats. So they really need a mix. You can't make a one, you know, for deer, what they tend to do, because they have, of course, a larger home range. You know, they used to make open fields for a deer to feed in. And they put one here and put one there. That really doesn't work for snakes. They have to have habitats close enough together. Their normal home range, they're only gonna move about a mile and a half in any direction. So you can't really say, let's make a nice place for them to nest here, and then we've taken care of it. There has to be an intermix of habitats. And the aquatic habitats are going to be important, but they also have to be a mix of habitats that have been there for a while. You can't like create them because they need to have old rotting logs to go down to burrow into for the summer heat. And as it turns out, to get away from fires, a really hot fire. If a snake is in a log, it's going to burn up with the log. So they need a mix of habitats that have been there for a while to provide not only the habitats they need above ground, like open areas for nesting and basking, and in the case of rattlesnakes, they need good open places to bask before they give birth, but they need the denser forest to look for prey, and they need wetlands to look for prey. And those have to be intermixed within a 2 or 3 mile area. You can't have large expanses of forests are going to have fewer pine snakes than habitats that are intermixed.
So we have something around 600,000 acres of public land within the Pinelands National Reserve, which the National Reserve area is 1.1 million acres, but that includes all the towns, cities. Does that mean that we're all set, that's all we need to do is have that parkland, or what's happening on that parkland that concerns you?
Okay. What is happening is that when you put a small road through, a small sand road through, people with off-road vehicles love to use these off-road vehicle areas. So they zip through there like crazy. And often the snakes will use these paths as well. And other wildlife will use them as well. And many snakes, including rattlesnakes and pine snakes, if a vehicle approaches on the road, they freeze. They don't like hurry to get off the road. They like freeze. And you can get out of the vehicle and go. And if you're a poacher, you pick it up and off you go. If you don't care about a snake, you just keep going at a rapid speed and you run over the snake because it froze. It's danger and it froze. So if you build small roads, the off-road vehicles come. If you decide, but still you might keep a closed canopy over the road, which is a good thing for snakes and so on. If you build a larger road and you get cars that are going fast, then A, the cars don't even see the snakes perhaps, and you start introducing predators. So roads are a problem for two reasons. They open the Pine Barrens to off-road vehicles and motorcycle people and so on. And they open them to poachers who now can get into the habitat they couldn't get into before. But you also open them up to the introduction of invasive plant species and to invasive animals. So things like coyotes and things like that are going to get farther into the pines than they would have otherwise. And raccoons and skunks and all those things are going to get farther into the pines than they would. And when people can get farther in the pines, then poachers can get farther in the pines. And when they can get farther in the pines, the off-road vehicles can get farther. So although we have preserved what to the average person looks like large tracts of forest, if they're broken up by roads and sand tracks, eventually that habitat becomes less usable. And if the roads become wide enough, and if they decide to build big, huge transmission lines through them, then that provides wonderful places for red-tailed hawks to sit. And pine snakes and other snakes are one of their favorite predators. Bob and I have lost a lot of pine snakes to red-tailed hawks because we found the remains with our transmitters in them, and we know that's what's happening. And so the problem is that you need a lot of deep, undisturbed pines to serve as a reserve, because in the 45 years or more Bob and I have been specifically looking at pine snakes, a large number of our good pine snake populations have disappeared. Because the pine snakes were like nesting on the edge of a little sand road, but that little sand road became a big sand road. And then they came through with bulldozers and they cleared away the sand banks at the edge of the road. So there was no habitat left. And it's very sad to see a pine snake digging its nest in the sand at the edge of what was an old sand road, where 50 feet away is a bulldozer building the road bigger. But the snakes are what we call philopatric, which means they come back, the females come back to lay, at least in pine snakes, in the same place every year. And so they're going to come back. And if you dig up their roadway where they've nested for, 50 years, they're going to still come back. And if you build a residential retirement community in the place where their hibernation site was, and it has a little cellar, the snakes are going to come back because that's where they hibernated for years. And people wonder, why is there pine snakes in my basement? This doesn't happen very often, but when it does happen, it's because that probably was a hibernation site that had been used for dozens of years. We have hibernation sites that we know about that we know were used in the early 1800s, because the early 1900s rather, because they were used by snake collectors that reported it, in the literature. And the same sites are used over and over. So we have to protect what we know is where we know it is, because you can't rebuild it. It doesn't really work.
What can people do to help pine snakes, to help wildlife within the Pinelands?
Well, I think the most important thing that anybody can do is education, is try to impress upon people the importance of particularly pine snakes within, and other snakes as well. But pine snakes are not poisonous. You can't hurt yourself. They're not hurting anybody. We need to build into the culture of the current pineys, the current retirement communities and people who've moved in there, and businesses and so on. We have to rebuild the culture that was there to begin with, that pine snakes are part of the ecosystem, that they're a rodent control and squirrel control mechanism, that yes, they eat some baby birds and they eat some bird eggs and they do some things like that. But that's all part of the system. It's all what's evolved in the system. So the first thing is education. The second thing, in my view, is to make snakes and other animals of the Pinelands accessible to people. People shouldn't be afraid of them, but they also shouldn't be in a position where they never get to see one or never get to hold one. So one of the things we can do is try to advocate for making it possible for kids to have experiences with snakes. I mean, I grew up with snakes and frogs and everything. Everything that I found, I brought home. I had baby birds. Everything I brought home. You can't do it now. It's like illegal, you know. And we ought to think about whether there's a way to bring back animals into the classroom so that when I grew up, you know, there were aquaria in the classroom in elementary school, and there were green frogs. There's a zillion green frogs in New Jersey. You know, almost every teacher could have a green frog in the classroom, and it's not going to hurt the green frog populations unless we do something like put chemicals in the environment that suddenly starts killing them. But other than that, the green frogs are doing well. Garter snakes are doing well. There are a number of different species that are doing well. And in classrooms where teachers were amenable to it and liked nature and wanted to do it, it should be possible for them to have these animals in their classroom without requiring them to pay $22 for a permit for each and every animal that they had and to renew it every year. That isn't going to work. Teachers don't have the money. They can't do it. It's not. So there's a lot of educational things that we could do. We ought to make it more possible for hobby naturalists who want to go to schools and give talks and give classroom things to be able to do it easily. So education is one big important thing, but it's not just kids. We need to go to senior citizens places and explain to them that the pine snake that goes through their property is not a danger, that they're not going to do anything. They're not going to harm them. They're just going to move through quietly and go back, because some of the retirement communities are between where the snakes have hibernated for years and where they've nested. And when that happens, the pine snake tries to get there any way it can get there. It'll cross roads. It will cross lawns. Bob and I have had snakes do this, go a long distance, even though somebody says, I built them a new hibernaculum. Why don't they use that? They're programmed to go back to where they have been. So education is a really, really big thing. The second thing is to think really carefully about where we put new roads and to lobby not to have organizations be able to make new bike trails through the Pinelands every time they want to have an enduro race. We should develop a plan where maybe for a 5-year period they can develop a new trail for each race, but then they go back to the original trail in year 5. So then instead of building a new trail every year for 50 years, we reuse some of the old trails. We can take some of the trails that have been illegally made through the Pine Barrens and actually block them off. Block them off with old trees or things so they're not easy to get into. We can think of developing ways to protect known nesting areas. Poaching is a hard thing to get at because the pine snakes nest back in the pines. And as you well know, because we tried to do this, if you put up cameras and you see somebody, it takes too long for you to even get in there to try to find out what they're doing. So education is the most important thing at all levels, from kids to senior citizens. Trying to show people the role, not just snakes, but the role of different kinds of organisms within the Pinelands and the importance of maintaining that. But also we need to show them the importance of the Pinelands to their own well-being in terms of long-term climate change, the aquifer in our water, the system around us that keeps the environment green. There's a lot of things that we can do to try to increase awareness of these things. And we can also, on the other hand, tell people the ways in which they can make their time in the Pinelands more enjoyable. I just found out recently from a friend of mine who's doing a lot of research with chiggers and other kinds of things that you don't like, I don't like, nobody likes to get in the Pinelands. And they primarily like to concentrate on all dead logs that are lying down. There's a much higher concentration. So suddenly I began to realize that when I get tired, I shouldn't just sit on the closest log I come to. So, I mean, there's a kind of, there's a few things that we could make people aware of that would make their experience better without making any difference. I mean, you know, if you go with somebody who you know is going to want to sit down, take a little camp stool they can sit on, you know, if you're taking your grandmother or somebody and they want to sit down or what. I mean, there's a lot of things we can do to make it more accessible, but I think education is the primary thing we have to do.
Here's a follow-up question to that, and it goes into the education component. Are we growing enough people that actually can speak up for the snakes, can speak up for other wildlife? Do we have enough people in the pipeline that are going to be able to continue the mission, so to speak?
No. And there's a couple of different reasons for that. One is that a lot of the people in the pipeline who would study these things are taking a university route. There's sort of three routes you can take: a university route, a conservation organization route, or a consulting route. If you think about where people are coming from who study any of these things outdoors, the university route is becoming harder because people have to try to get grants, and we are not, as a country, funding that kind of research. I mean, Bob and I have been doing this research for, you know, 45 years. And we've had almost zero funding from anybody. It's stuff we've done because we love it and we believe in it. It's getting harder for people in universities to do that. I could do it because I do other things that I have other funding for. But it's, so that's the first thing that we have to think about, is how do we fund things? The funding goes into the conservation organizations as well. Both groups are not getting sufficient funding to do the kind of conservation work that takes a long time without immediate results. I mean, a lot of the studies that we have done that are most successful have taken 20 or 30 years to get enough data to see what's going on. It's hard to get that funding for either anybody in a university or anybody in a conservation organization. So we have to try to do that. The third route is the consultant route. And that's one way that we can get some information. That is, the state and other organizations, permitting organizations, can require follow-up studies when somebody does some project. We can require efficacy studies, not just do the study now to see if there's a problem, but we need to have consultants need to have to be paid adequately to do not only the study about right now, but while the project is going on, whatever the development is, and after the project is done. And by that, I mean, many, many years ago, I was involved in, and I don't need to mention it, in a place where they wanted to build a golf course. And I was called in because of the pine snake population. And we had a big discussions about it. And there was money to, you know, to do the initial part. But the problem is that there's no money to follow through and say, well, if you only developed half the land for a golf course and the other half was left, is that successful? Did the pine snake population live there? Did they continue to exist? And by and large, nobody likes to pay for those kinds of things. So that's a really big problem that we need to think about, is how we can build into the system that the people who have the money, which is not either the conservation organizations or the university, how can we build into the system information so we can find out what works? You know, what really does work? What keeps populations of corn snakes or pine snakes or tree frogs or whatever? What keeps those populations there? How much area do we really need undisturbed? Those kinds of questions are hard to answer, but we need to begin to answer them. And we have to figure out ways to reinforce the people who want to do these kind of studies. And that leads to, I think, it also, we also need to start thinking about funding people in conservation organizations at an equal level to people who would be at a university or some other place, so that people want to go into that field. Because otherwise, people are going to look around and they're going to say, well, I can't support a family on this or whatever. And so I think we need to, those of us who are still in this, we need to think about how can we build up the pipeline of young people to go into whichever of those three they want. And then whichever of those three they want to go into, how are we going to get the money to encourage long enough term studies to be able to answer the questions that you ask? How can we preserve these things? New Jersey population is growing. It's going to continue to grow. People want to have wild land. There is now really compelling data that having availability to green spaces and trees and wildlife is not only good because people think it's good, but that there are health consequences, that there are fewer heart problems and fewer all kinds of different problems when people have access to green spaces. And that means we have to think also in terms of how to bring urban and suburban people into not only the pinelands, but other habitats, not so that we build big roads and bring people in and say, look at this forest, isn't this great, but so that people can have a meaningful experience. And nature centers have a big role in that, because that's one place where kids, you know, can get educated. But I agree with you. When I look around at the people who are studying a lot of the wildlife and plants in the Pine Barrens, they're all over 50, and many are over 60, and many of us are over 70. And, you know, it's hard to get new people interested in it because the world is changing.
So here's a big topic, and you don't have to answer it if you don't want to, but are we set with the framework of management, or should we be looking to change how public land is managed in the Pinelands? Because we have state parks, we have wildlife management areas, we have natural lands trust preserves, we have county lands, we have municipal lands. We have the Forest Fire Service that doesn't necessarily interact with under the direct control of any of those other services. State Park Police, not under the direct control or in cooperation with any of those other services.
Ideally, we have to, and you know, when the Pinelands was first set up, it really, that was the intent, is that the Pinelands Commission would have control over the area. And so development and other activities would all fall under that. And it could work in that way. And then, of course, to some extent, like all organizations, the Pinelands is partly political. Towns and cities are political, you know, and we've got all these different agencies which don't all necessarily agree. And I mean, even if you just look at the permitting process, that's a huge problem. I mean, to work on pine snakes, I've got to get a permit from this place and that place and some other place and some other place, and they don't all agree with what I should or shouldn't do. And you get the feeling, and it's sort of what I was trying to say with teachers. The permitting process for teachers is sufficiently difficult that they're not going to do it, and we don't get the education. So when we talk about land management, we really need to figure out a way that everybody doesn't have their little fiefdom of what it is they control, and without discussing it with each other. And now I don't know how one could do that, since the Pinelands Commission initially we thought was going to be able to do some of that thing stuff. But each organization has gotten so large with so many so much red tape and permits and all kind of processes that you have to go through, that it's hard to coordinate them. And what I'm concerned about is that sometimes the Pinelands is a wonderful example of trying to integrate people and wildlife and wild habitats. And I agree with it in principle. I think the difficulty is as the population in the Pinelands increases and there are more residential and retirement communities that require servicing everything from police departments and restaurants to whatever, there's only so much space. And that has to mean that there's going to be less wild space. And what I am worried about is that over the 50 years, what I have seen is when you build bigger roads and when you build more houses, the pine snakes recede farther into the pines. And it's not the stable system that it was for probably 200 or 300 years when people, when Europeans first got in the pines, or when the Indians were there for that matter. I mean, they burned part of the pines to keep deer populations up and so on. But their practices probably helped the animals that lived in the pine because they kept some places open, but not everything. But I am really worried that the encroachment of roads, high tension wires, fire breaks, and such is making the areas smaller and smaller and making more and more edge areas. And edge areas means more invasive species, more people, more animals killed on roads.
So what do you think we should do about it?
What should we do about it? What should we do about it? Well, I mean, partly my feeling is that we can make inroads in the lands that are preserved, like the state forests and places like that. Management areas, we need to think a little bit about because they were often developed for, you know, deer production or whatever initially. They have a different kind of use. I think attention to the state forests is something that we could spend more time on. It may be that one needs to think about having more of the human activities in like wildlife management areas rather than in the forest, or think about actually sit down with different people and say, look, this is what's happening. We're getting more people everywhere. That's a good thing. But we need to figure out how to mitigate it in such a way that it's not a problem. And what I mean by that is, you know, when you think about what's happened coastally, we've just along the Atlantic coast, it's just developed everywhere, right? And the birds that used to nest on the beaches are now forced to nest in salt marsh islands. And they were doing fine on salt marsh islands for, you know, 40 years. But with global warming and sea level rise, those islands are not as usable. And so we have to just face the fact that if the bird populations are going to exist, we have to do something. And we may be, we are earlier than that with the state forests. But I think we need to sit down and talk about what are the state forests for? Are they for protecting the communities that live around there? So we have to, the biggest thing we need to worry about is forest fires, which are going to increase with climate change. Is that what we need to worry about? And if that's the case, then maybe we need to have some more hardcore areas where we're not going to develop so that we don't have that same problem. I mean, I don't know. I'm not smart enough to figure this all out, but I think that we have to get young people together. It is going to be their world, and try to figure out how to dovetail the needs of people with the needs of the wildlife and the needs of the natural intermix of habitats that's there when we're not there. If you walk deep into the pines, I mean, this fire that just happened, Bob and I were out there the other day and we were surprised. It was a really hot, scorching fire, and I'm afraid I might have lost half of my stakes. I'm totally upset and panicked. But, and in any case, it was a really hot fire, and you could see the ground. And so for the first time in 40 years, we could see how undulating it is and how many little back aquatic areas that were scattered around that we couldn't see because the forest was so dense. So we need to think about how do we keep that and maintain that diversity of habitats, which is kept the New Jersey pinelands more pristine than the other pine barrens I know of. I mean, pine snakes, for example, I mean, I don't mean to bore you with pine snakes because I really liked them a lot, but New Jersey is the center of pine snake distribution. It's not the center of the physical distribution, but this is the only place you can reliably find pine snakes. The rest of their distribution is hundreds of miles south and in Tennessee and the Carolinas and all those places where they used to be, you cannot find them. You have to work really, really hard to find one, and you might never find one. We have a responsibility. This is where the population is surviving. This is where they're left. If we don't protect this population, they could disappear, period. I mean, it's really that critical. This is where the pine snake distribution is. And we need to think about how many other species that's true of, because they were from the south and from the north, and this is where they met.
Well said. Well said.
I think we've done more than you wanted.
I think just enough, actually. Okay. Well, I know you have a lot to get to. So just wanted to thank you for your years of service in protecting pine snakes and wildlife of all kinds into the Pine Barrens. And
thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining on the podcast today. And I think we can give people a firm direction to go in on some of this, especially with state forest land. And
I think it's a real opportunity because I think that people are beginning to realize if we don't work together, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's it. Okay. Have a nice day.
So, all right. Thanks, Joanna. Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, have you ever walked straight out in the pines, leaving all your fears and troubles far behind? Well, I like that feeling I get when I jump.